You're listening to NPR on Health. I'm your host, Joe Neal. There were a lot of good health stories on the radio this week, so I had a bit of trouble picking out the ones that I really liked, but I've come up with a list of five for you. The first two explore the connections between loneliness and isolation and health. Then we'll hear a story about Alzheimer's and a new theory about what causes it. Next, you'll probably be surprised to hear that many surgeons operate without any kind of formal checklist, and some say that's leading to mistakes. And finally, you may want to duck and cover when you hear the last story. It's about preparations for a nuclear attack. Our first story looks at a Japanese inventor's unusual answer to a serious problem. People who live in nursing homes can sometimes suffer from loneliness, boredom, and social isolation. So some nursing homes are turning to the invention. It's a fuzzy little robot, NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports.
Anyone who's ever loved a dog or a cat knows how much an animal companion can bring to a person's life. But lots of retirement homes don't allow them. For example, pets can only visit at Vinson Hall's Arleigh Burke Pavilion in McLean, Virginia. But this retirement community does offer its residents something else. A nurse is holding what looks like a kid's stuffed animal. It's a baby seal. A robot baby seal. I watch as an aide helps Virginia Long use a walker to slowly come into the activity room. When she sits down, the nurse puts the seal on her lap. It's named Ollie. The robot sort of quivers as Virginia Long talks to it.
What are you shivering for? Are you cold? Yes.
Okay. I can't tell when Ollie is happy and not happy.
No. Either. Are you happy? Are you happy, Ollie?
The seal has soft white fur and big black eyes. As Virginia Long strokes it, the eyes open and close. You don't think it's strange to have a seal for a pet?
Well, it's odd, yes. But a lot of people have odd animals.
Later, as other people come in for bingo, I asked her why she likes the robot.
Because it's alive and you can work with it. Pet it, rub it.
Do you have a pet now?
I did, but I don't now. I had a cat. But somebody stole him.
This seal has been available in Japan for several years under the brand name Paro. The robots sell for a few thousand bucks. Now, a new company in Florida plans to bring the seal to the U.S. And whether that's a good thing or a bad thing depends on who you ask. The inventor thinks it's a good thing. Takanori Shibata works at Japan's National Institute of Advanced Industrial Science and Technology. He built the seal to explore how people can make emotional connections to robots. He says he tried robotic cats and dogs, but people didn't find those convincing.
When I asked people to evaluate cat robot or dog robot, they expected too much, and they became critical to the robot.
But people have no idea what a baby seal is supposed to do. So even though the robot can't walk or play games, they just think it's cute. Look at an x-ray, though, and the cuteness disappears. The robot has seriously high-tech innards, little motors, computer chips, and sensors for sound, light, and touch.
And when people stroke Paro, Paro feels good. And the whiskers are also sensors. So Paro responds to my touch.
So he doesn't like that?
No, he doesn't like it.
So if you touch his whiskers, he just sort of makes a sound and moves his head away?
Yeah.
Shibata says people have done scientific studies showing that the seal can reduce stress and provide comfort to people in nursing homes. And there's a real market for that.
I've kind of gotten attached to her, and I can see how people can get attached to her. I treat her like she's real.
That's Nancy Chilla. She's head of nursing at the Arleigh Burke Pavilion. She says they first got the robot in April to test it with about a dozen residents.
If I walk down the hall, groups of people will stop. Residents will wave to have Ollie come over. And they actually remember her now when she comes out.
When they're interacting with Ollie, are they aware that Ollie is a robot?
They are. They have said that they're aware that she's a robot, but they love her just the same.
Well, not everybody. Chilla says one person was very agitated. But in general, this retirement community is enthusiastic. What would be the advantage of this over just, say, a cat?
Well, when I go home, I plug Ollie into the charger and turn him off, and I leave for the weekend. Whereas a cat, you have to feed, you have to have a litter box, you have to take to the vet. Ollie just goes to sleep, and we don't have to worry about her until Monday.
There's no need to worry because the robot is not alive. And some people say that's actually the problem.
One of the things that we've learned is that it is the unexpected and spontaneous behavior of the living creature that adds so much of the value to people's experience.
Bill Thomas is a physician and professor of aging studies at the Erickson School at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He says nursing homes can accommodate pets if they want to. In fact, he pioneered a reform movement in elder care called the Eden Alternative. It involves filling older people's homes with lots of animals, plants, and children.
I can say with confidence that people in that reform movement really are not looking for a robot to solve our problems.
Even though if people are lonely and bored, he says almost any kind of novelty can get their attention.
I have no doubt that I could thrill a group of older people with a fur-covered robot. I know I can. But it doesn't solve anything. It doesn't solve the problem that is really causing their distress and their lack of enjoyment of life.
He says, sure, caring for other living creatures takes work. It can sometimes be a hassle. But it also gives people a real emotional connection. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
There's a video of the baby seal robot on our website. You can get to it by clicking on Health and Science on the left side of the homepage. Now we'll go from robot friends to real friends, people that is. Researchers know that social ties and taking part in leisure activities are two things that can predict good health in later life. But, you know, it can be hard making friends as you get older. NPR's Allison Aubrey talked to an 81-year-old man whose new hobby is opening up a whole new world of friendship for him.
The church choir is one way that people can connect through music, but 81-year-old Art Himmel is cut from a different cloth. He gets a charge from performing karaoke, occasionally at senior centers, but also at an L.A. nightclub.
Performing for the first time tonight, ladies and gentlemen, the man of the hour. Let's give it up for Art!
Tonight, it all began to... I saw you, and the world went away.
Part of Art's story is told in a short documentary shown at the American Film Institute's Silver Docs Festival this month. You can also find a link to the documentary on NPR's website. When we spoke to Art from his apartment in L.A., he explained that at this stage in life, he and his wife have lost a lot of their longtime friends. Some have moved away, some have died, and others have just slowed down to the point they don't go out much.
But when I started doing karaoke, I got new friends, much younger. But I think that the nicest aspect of that is they'll call if they don't see me and find out if I'm okay. So there's concern on their part.
Despite battling colon cancer and dealing with other disappointments in the last few years, Art says he thinks the singing and the interaction with people keeps him going. And researchers who study aging say there's a lot to this.
The story of this karaoke singer certainly fits the pattern that we've seen in our data.
Carlos Mendez de Leon is a researcher with the Rush Institute for Healthy Aging. He says there's a lot of evidence to suggest that being engaged in the world with people reduces the risk of disability and mental decline. And a recent study from Australia finds some relationships, namely friendships, may be even more protective than ties with family when it comes to longevity. Mendez de Leon says one possible explanation is that we're expected to maintain relationships with siblings and children.
But relationships with friends tend to perhaps provide more positive outcomes because they are discretionary.
To keep friendships up, people usually do things together, whether it's something as simple as going to lunch, volunteering, or singing karaoke. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Thank you.
The most common explanation for Alzheimer's is that it's caused by a sticky material called amyloid. The idea is that amyloid, which is a protein, builds up in the brain and starts killing brain cells. But two new studies that are out this week suggest that it's not amyloid that's causing the problem, it's calcium. NPR's John Hamilton explains.
While most researchers have concentrated on the role of amyloid plaques in Alzheimer's, a few have long suspected that the real culprit might be calcium. Kevin Foskett of the University of Pennsylvania is one of those researchers. He says there wasn't that much evidence the calcium hypothesis was right until today's publication of the two new studies.
Taking these two papers together will force everyone in the Alzheimer's field to put the calcium hypothesis much more on the map than it has been.
Foskett, who is an author of both papers, says the hypothesis goes like this. Calcium molecules pass in and out of individual brain cells.
Cells can let calcium come in from the outside, or they also have stores of calcium that they keep inside them, and they can release that calcium from the inside of the cell into the cytoplasm.
In order to stay healthy, brain cells need to maintain just the right amount of calcium at any given moment. That depends on cells responding to signals from elsewhere in the brain. Foskett and others think an abnormal response to these signals leads to abnormal calcium levels in brain cells, which ultimately leads to Alzheimer's. One of the new studies appears to confirm the link between calcium and Alzheimer's. Philippe Marambeau of Albert Einstein Medical College says the study identifies a gene linked to both Alzheimer's and the calcium balance in brain cells. He says people who carry one copy of the gene are at least 44% more likely to develop the disease.
So it's extremely significant, and it could potentially affect a lot of individuals.
This is only the second gene that's been linked to the most common form of Alzheimer's. And Marambeau says scientists know a lot about the chemicals it produces in the brain.
So we have potentially not only identified a new risk factor, but also a gene product that could be targeted for drug discovery and therapy.
Future drugs might be designed to correct abnormal calcium levels in brain cells. So far, efforts to treat Alzheimer's have focused on preventing or eliminating the buildup of amyloid. The second new study suggests how an imbalance in calcium might actually cause Alzheimer's. Researchers looked at brain cells from people who have a rare inherited form of the disease that can strike a person before they reach 40. They found that these people carry genes that not only cause amyloid buildup, but also problems with calcium regulation. And the study found that when calcium regulation went awry, brain cells produced more amyloid. Sam Gandy with the Alzheimer's Association says that suggests a brand new way of looking at an old disease.
It seems that calcium and amyloid have a sort of hand-in-glove or even vicious cycle sort of relationship. So one can cause the other, and they can begin a vicious cycle that we think can lead to the disease.
All the scientists warned against trying to prevent Alzheimer's by changing the amount of calcium in your diet or by taking drugs that affect the way cells use calcium. The new studies appear in the journals Cell and Neuron. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Here's a statistic that I found surprising. Every year, one out of every 25 people in the world has a major operation. That translates to about 234 million surgeries a year. Now, I'm sure you've read news reports like I have about surgeons operating on the wrong arm or the wrong side of the brain or even the wrong person. The World Health Organization's launching a program to try to do something about it, and it's as simple as drawing up a laundry list. NPR's Richard Knox tells us more.
The WHO wants every hospital around the world to start using its simple checklist. For patient Daniel Boxty, it starts even before he's wheeled into the operating room at the University of Washington Medical Center. Nurse Brian Green has some questions.
I know what we're doing for you today, but I have to ask you to tell me.
Two hernias. We could fix two hernias.
Okay. And they're bilateral groin, correct? Yes.
Once Boxty's asleep in the OR, surgeon Brant Oschlager calls a halt to the proceedings.
Okay. Everybody ready for the timeout?
Yeah.
Let's first everyone in the room introduce themselves so we know who the team is.
I'm Matt, anesthesia.
Tony, medical student.
Juan Parra, surgery resident.
After everybody knows who's who, Olschlager runs through part two of the new checklist.
And we're going to do a laparoscopic bilateral inguinal hernia repair today. Has the patient had DVT prophylaxis with subcutaneous heparin?
Yes.
A surgical checklist is new. Dr. Patchen-Dellinger of the University of Washington says people are often surprised to hear it.
When I explain to people who are not in medicine that we're introducing a formal checklist process into the operating room, one of the common reactions I get is, "You mean you weren't doing that before? Good heavens."
But there's plenty of evidence that the absence of a systematic check is causing many an operating room disaster.
You only have to pick up the newspapers to read about patients, you know, having the wrong foot or the wrong kidney removed or the wrong level of spinal disc operation.
Just this week, New Jersey authorities suspended one surgeon's license after he removed the wrong lung from a patient, then tried to conceal the mistake. The new WHO checklist has 22 items over three stages, before, during, and after an operation. Among other things, people on the team have to verify if they're about to operate on the right patient, with the right procedure, in the right place, if a patient has allergies, if the patient may need blood, if he's had pre-op antibiotics, if at the end there are any instruments or sponges unaccounted for, they might be inside the patient. The WHO tapped Dr. Atul Gawande to head an international task force to devise the checklist. Gawande is a Boston surgeon and a professor at the Harvard School of Public Health who writes frequently about how things go wrong in medicine. He says it's important that the checklist is verbal, not on paper.
There's actually been good studies from the nuclear power industry that people are more than 10 times more likely to avoid missing a step when they have to verbally confirm with somebody else that they met that step rather than just check it off on a piece of paper.
Because it's public?
Because it's public.
Eight medical centers around the world have been using the surgical checklist. At the start, they were doing everything they should only a third of the time. 1,000 operations later, that improved to two-thirds of the time. There's been resistance. One London surgeon thought it was demeaning Mickey Mouse stuff, until one day...
Right before the incision, they took the time out. And when it came to the nurse's turn to raise any concerns, the nurse asked, "Are we really sure we have the right size knee replacement for this patient?"
Turns out they didn't, not anywhere in the hospital. That surgeon now swears by the new surgical checklist, and Gawande wants to extend it to other parts of the hospital. Richard Knox, NPR News.
By the way, that 1 in 25 statistic that I mentioned earlier comes from a report published this week in the British journal The Lancet. If you want to see the checklist, you can find it at our website, npr.org/yourhealth. Now, if you know someone who was a child during the Cold War, or you were a child yourself during that period, you've probably heard about duck and cover drills, where children were told to dive under their desks. The fear was a nuclear attack from the Soviet Union. And the government put out helpful films like this one.
It looks something like this. There is a bright flash, brighter than the sun, brighter than anything you've ever seen. If you were not ready and did not know what to do, it could hurt you in different ways. It could knock you down hard or throw you against a tree or a wall. It is such a big explosion, it can smash in buildings and knock signboards over and break windows all over town. But if you duck and cover, like Bert, you will be much safer.
I remember that film, and it did scare the you-know-what out of you. Critics say that the films were really only good for doing just that, scaring people. They didn't do much to prepare people. But with current concerns about terrorism, the question about how to respond to a nuclear explosion is getting new attention. The National Academy of Sciences held a workshop here in Washington this week, and NPR's David Kestenbaum was there.
As you might expect, this was not a cheery gathering. But on the bright side, the Cold War is over. No one worries anymore about thousands of megaton bombs wiping out the country. No, the concern now is a single, much smaller bomb, like the one dropped on Hiroshima. Till Jolly with the Department of Homeland Security tried to set the tone.
There are those who would like to do this to us. Is it likely? I don't know. I don't know if it's likely. It's one of those things that 0% if it doesn't happen, and it's 100% if it does. And I think we owe it to the nation to do the most we can to prepare for a potentially catastrophic event. So I want to thank all of you.
If your reaction is, I can't think about a nuclear attack, it's just too unthinkable. Well, you're not alone. Cham Dallas at the University of Georgia has given hundreds of lectures. Often, he says, people's eyes glaze over.
That glaze factor is stunning. And I'm talking about physicians and nurses and experienced planners. I almost feel like you have to use humor or something to break through it, do a Seinfeld routine or something, just to get through to people to where they'll listen.
Brooke Buttermeyer, a radiation safety specialist at Lawrence Livermore National Lab, put up maps from computer simulations showing what would happen if a Hiroshima-type bomb went off near the White House. The surrounding blocks get pretty much vaporized, but outside that zone, like, say, here, a mile away at the National Academy of Sciences, buildings and people could survive.
Fortunately, when I look at this building, it looks pretty solid to me, unless that's all fake. Hopefully we've got at least 12 inches of wall, and maybe 24, which means we're actually doing pretty good.
Buttermeyer noted dryly that he would have been killed. He was standing next to a window where he wouldn't be shielded from the initial radiation blast and where he'd be hit by broken glass. In fact, windows would break several miles away from the bomb. But there is that region, a sort of gray zone outside the area of total destruction, where thousands and thousands of people would need medical care. Injuries from fires, fallen buildings, radiation. Buttermeyer says few states and local communities have coordinated response plans.
I get a lot of, if a nuke goes off, that's the feds, right? We just step back and wait for them? Well, I hope not, because decisions made in the first few hours and actions taken in the first few minutes have the most critical life-saving capabilities.
Hospitals would be overwhelmed. Colonel John Mercier with the Armed Forces Radiobiology Research Institute said doctors need to be trained to assess quickly who is savable and who is not. He suggested giving out colored wristbands.
Clinicians have to have the moral courage to understand they cannot devote all their attention to just a few patients, and they're going to have to decide, you know what, we don't have the resources for this person or that person, and move on. That's the hard part.
Farther from the blast, there would be the danger of radioactive material carried by the winds. Fred Mettler is chief of radiology at the New Mexico VA healthcare system.
Early fallout is very, very radioactive. It sort of comes down looking like salt.
But Mettler says in a couple days, the material loses a lot of its radioactivity, and there are simple things people can do to protect themselves.
Staying inside where it can't drop on you, or if it has dropped on you, changing your clothes and washing is really may save your life at the end of the day.
I asked Mettler what he thought the best response to a bomb would be, and he said defuse it before it goes off. The final slide of his presentation showed an American flag and two words, good luck. David Kestenbaum, NPR News.
You can see the entire duck and cover video I mentioned at npr.org. That's it for this week. I couldn't put all the health stories into this podcast, so you might want to go to our website to find more. They're on the Health and Science page. You can also hear more health stories by tuning into your local NPR station. Thanks for listening. I'm Joe Neal, NPR News.